From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA, and I'm Maria Hinojosa. Just a year ago, Hurricane Sandy tore up the Atlantic coast of the United States.
Up and down the East Coast, residents were warned to stay home and take mandatory evacuation orders for low-lying areas seriously.
This is not a time to be stupid.
Here in New York, streets and subways were flooded, skyscrapers closed down, homes abandoned.
It wasn't a big house, but I think they gave my family like $2,400 or something to fix it. You know, didn't even cover like the stuff in the kitchen.
Today, the things we've lost and the things we've found since Sandy. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There have been markers in New York City, posters, photos, stories on local TV, all reminders of the one-year anniversary of a storm no one could have imagined would hit this city of skyscrapers. A year ago, in the last days of October, Hurricane Sandy struck the East Coast, causing about $50 billion in damage. Poor residents, particularly immigrants, were especially vulnerable and invisible. Latino USA producer Diana Montaño went to Staten Island, one of the hardest hit parts of the city, to check in with residents 1 year after Sandy.
A group of Staten Island residents meets in a small office on a Wednesday night. They're getting ready for a protest set to coincide with the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy. The storm destroyed a large part of Staten Island, and 1 year later, many residents are still struggling to get back on their feet.
I mean, as far as FEMA goes, we didn't get nothing. I mean, I think they gave my family like $2,400 or something to fix it. You know, didn't even cover like the stuff in the kitchen.
Marcos Baez lived in his childhood home for 29 years. As a U.S. citizen, he was eligible for reconstruction assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. But others, particularly undocumented immigrants, had a harder time getting help. Flor Olea is an undocumented single mother from Oaxaca, Mexico. Though she doesn't have papers, she was eligible to apply for emergency assistance on behalf of her U.S.-born daughter. A few weeks after the storm, she went to stand in line to apply for food stamps. She says the woman in charge simply took one look at her and turned her away. What pains Flor is that in the 20 years she's lived in the U.S., she never applied for public assistance. But in this time of need, the help simply wasn't there. She was so sad and angry that she never returned.
Me dio coraje y ya no quise regresar.
Flor's situation is only made harder by the fact that she hasn't been able to find steady work since the storm.
La verdad es que el trabajo está más difícil. Algunas de las señoras con las que yo trabajaba se mudaron de aquí, se fueron de acá.
Like many immigrant women on the island, she had worked cleaning houses. But when the families that she worked for sold their properties and left after the storm, they took the work with them.
Para estar de cuidando niños y pues ha sido difícil.
Marcos, the lifelong resident still rebuilding his house, used to work at the port. Now he lives on his sister's couch while he rebuilds his house.
It's going to be another year before I get back on my feet right now. Because, I mean, the way things are going right now, it's either I go to work and stop trying to rebuild the house that I'm in, or I keep rebuilding the house and stay broke.
And the blow to homeowners is also being felt by tenants. Veronica Gloria, who has also lived in Staten Island for 2 decades, used to live in an apartment with her husband and 2 children.
Donde vivíamos,
Before, they paid $700 a month. Now they pay $1,200.
Entonces, solos, pues, no podíamos.
So this is something that we have seen happen after lots of disasters. After Katrina, rents also went up like 40%.
Melissa Crum is the Sandy Response Coordinator for the community organization Make the Road New York. They've been helping residents since the storm hit.
We think it's for a number of reasons. One is there's a lot less housing stock, so landlords have that room to charge higher rents. Another thing is landlords, just like everybody else, have struggled to rebuild, and a lot of them went into their own, you know, savings or what have you to rebuild as quickly as possible. And then, you know, what we think is going on is they're raising the rent to kind of make up that loss.
So Make the Road is organizing residents to demand that the city come up with a reconstruction plan that includes affordable housing options. Since the storm, Flor Olea had to relocate and move in with more family members. She now lives with a sister, two brothers, her daughter, and three nieces, and they all share a small two-bedroom apartment. The narrow living room is attached to the kitchen, and there's barely enough room for a couch. Her brother, Jose Luis, is an aspiring DJ who lost all his equipment to the storm. He says it can be uncomfortable. They have to accommodate each other and deal with each other's bad moods. But despite all that's been lost, Flor says she's found one thing that wasn't as strong before the storm, her community.
Como que hubo un poquito más de unión, de comunicación entre paisanos, se puede decir.
She says now there's more communication between paisanos, her fellow Mexicans. That before they would see each other and just go their separate ways. But now they greet each other and talk about how to rebuild together. For Latino USA, I'm Diana Montaño.
So, did Hurricane Sandy affect you? Or have you ever become closer to your neighbors because of a natural disaster or a crisis? Tell us your story on Facebook and on Twitter at Latino USA. For families without documents, or for Americans who worry about being racially profiled in this country and having to prove their status, the prospect of losing everything, including important paperwork, is especially devastating. The floods that swept through Colorado last month are a stark reminder. Reporter and producer Leslie McClurg of Colorado Public Radio spoke to some of the Latino and immigrant victims of that flood in that state, and she's here to tell us more about them and what they went through. Leslie, welcome to Latino USA.
Hello.
So when the floods happened, you immediately said to yourself, you know what? There are going to be under-the-radar people who live in the state of Colorado who are undocumented or are mixed-status families, and you wanted to find out what life was like after the floods for them.
Yes, I was actually up in Evans, Colorado, which is northeast of Denver, and I was at a shelter, and I noticed that there was a large percentage of the people at the shelter that were of Latino heritage, and I knew that there were meatpacking plants and farms in that area that had a lot of immigrant workers, and I thought, wow, I bet this population has really suffered greatly, and so I started reaching out and talking to people, and the stories that I heard were really, really, really heartbreaking.
And let's hear a little bit of that, because you spoke to several families. You spoke to a woman by the name of Agustina Temu, who's from Guatemala and actually is a citizen of the United States. Let's hear her voice for a moment.
We don't have a stable place to stay. Sometimes we're in the shelter and sometimes with friends.
So Agustina's husband, even though she's a citizen, her husband is undocumented and he's from Mexico. Tell us the story, Leslie, of what happened when they came for her family when the river started to rise.
Agustina was working that evening. It was 4 a.m. in the morning, and she's a custodian at Walmart. And she was working that evening. Her husband and their four-year-old son were at home. And her husband, Omar Carmona, heard a pounding at the door, which he thought was maybe ICE. He thought they were maybe coming. And he didn't want to answer the door. And so for over an hour, he resisted until finally, you know, a neighbor convinced him to open the door. So he relented and ended up, you know, being the last one out of their trailer home park to evacuate.
Now, you spoke to another family, the Sanchez family. They also lost a lot. Tell us the story of the Sanchez family and what it means, again, to lose important paperwork at a moment like this in their lives.
What's interesting about the Sanchez family is they were further downriver, so the water didn't actually hit at such a height until the next day. And so when the water hit, their trailer was actually uprooted. They did lose everything. The trailer literally was swept away. You know, their green cards, their marriage certificate, the title for their trailer, their daughter's DACA status, the documents that she needs to prove that. The son's passport, U.S. passport. And so they lost everything in this flood.
Is there any sense? I mean, you actually spoke to a lawyer, an immigration attorney, about what this family could do. And let's take a listen to that first.
This would be a family who would obviously qualify for immigration reform. They've been here for many years. They have U.S. citizen family member. They've paid their taxes. They haven't committed crimes. But they're going to need to document their presence in the United States. They're going to need bills and proof of, you know, money sent to Mexico, proof of money earned here. They've lost all of that.
Did this lawyer say anything about what to do to remedy that problem?
Well, it's going to be a long road that she says is even more difficult, often because of the language barrier. None of the folks in the Sanchez family speak English. The daughter will have to file a FOIA request to the government to ask for a copy of her file. That could take up to a year. But Jose is actually the father of the family. He's in deportation status. And so he's also fighting to stay in the country.
Was there any concrete information about a way to help families like this? Because obviously the Sanchez family, there are many, many more like them.
Exactly. Yeah. The Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition did say that it's at least hundreds, maybe thousands that are in the same situation. FEMA was actually making a really concerted effort to try to reach these folks through different advocacy organizations saying, look, we will respect your privacy. We do want to help you. Those folks who are on the margins, even those who do have, you know, mixed status in their families and are worried about their privacy, we will protect that. So surprisingly to these families, help and aid is available and was available. The problem is that FEMA aid for families of mixed status might only be available for a very short period of time, sort of an emergency situation.
So, you know, considering that there was a Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast, that you have these natural disasters that are hitting our country that has, you know, millions of undocumented folks living here. Would you say that the federal and state relief efforts, now that there was this flood disaster in Colorado, has gotten better for Latinos and for immigrants?
You know, gotten better. I think it's difficult to say. The aid is there, but on FEMA's website is also the Homeland Security logo. And so many families don't know that aid is actually available. I did another story about service workers up in Estes Park. And, you know, let's say they work at a hotel or a restaurant that's been closed because the roads are closed. And so they laid off all these workers. Those families that I talked to had no idea. They did not know that FEMA aid was available. So many of them were leaving town, some going back to Mexico, some going to other tourist towns in hopes of finding other work. So I don't know if you can say this situation has improved, because clearly a lot of people don't know that aid is available.
Leslie McClurg is a reporter and producer for Colorado Public Radio and spoke to us from Denver. Thanks again, Leslie.
Thank you.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Let's go through and repeat. My house, your house,
lost and found. One native Mexican language in Los Angeles. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Super el dolor que
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. At birth, we're assigned conditions that mark our lives: gender, race, and citizenship. In the U.S., like in the Dominican Republic, if you are born here, then you are a citizen. But that changed in the Dominican Republic 2 years ago when the Constitution was amended. A new law said you could only get Dominican citizenship if your parents were also Dominican citizens. So now you have to prove your family history. To Dominicans of Haitian descent, that matters, because the island of Hispaniola is split between Haiti and the DR.
They've threatened us. They'll go into our houses with machetes to do a massacre, just like the old government of Trujillo. That's why we're afraid.
When Latino USA went to the Dominican Republic in 2011 to report on how people of Haitian descent were being treated, we found a terrifying situation. I encountered a bus one morning filled with men about to be deported back to Haiti. I didn't think things could get worse, but they have.
Immigration reform may be a hot-button issue here in the U.S., but a recent court ruling in the Dominican Republic may top the list when it comes to controversial immigration laws. And for
one, Father, a decision issued by the Dominican Constitutional Court last month on September 23rd has stripped citizenship retroactively from people present in the country without papers since 1929. This means that three, maybe four generations, an estimated 250,000 people suddenly find themselves without a country.
La constitución actual, si alguien está en el país en un estatus que no es legal, pues definitivamente no es.
No citizenship means no ID. No ID cuts people off from schooling, from public services, and jobs.
We just need to take into consideration the timing of the sentence, September 23rd. Couple of days before the massacre in 1937. Take that in consideration and think of history repeating itself once again in a way that it's not with guns, it's not killing people, but it's actually depriving people of a right that they inherited.
That's Edison Suero talking about a massacre of tens of thousands of Haitians ordered by the Dominican government in 1937. Suero, a Dominican of Haitian descent, spoke at a panel about the issue this week at Columbia University.
I believe that education is the most powerful weapon in the world. When you educate a country, you cannot do things like this. You can.
New York has the largest Dominican population in the U.S. and one of the largest concentrations of Haitians. So the reaction here has been especially vocal. There have been multiple protests at Dominican consulates here in New York and in other cities, and more are planned. Angela Fernandez is the director of the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrant Rights, and she's helping to organize those protesting the ruling.
Northern Manhattan, a lot of community leaders have come together, and they're now meeting on a weekly basis to ensure that a campaign is established to stop this from a community response.
For Manuel Camacho, who works as a building doorman in the Bronx, the situation has brought out differences within his own family and friends.
I've been involved in acrimonious discussions online, Facebook. As a Dominican, you know, I've been called anti-patriotic, a traitor. You should be hanged. You should be lynched. As an immigrant that has been given a break in this country, I found it appalling that Dominicans in the islands are discriminating against other Dominicans.
Entering Dominican space has always been a very emotional experience and a very hard experience. So in New York, it's like easier because we're all people of color, and it's so much easier to like cross that border, you know?
That's Emmanuelle Mercier. She's a college student who moved to New York City after the 2010 earthquake in her native Haiti.
I mean, it should just spark people's anger and interest because it's like it's so hard to see people discriminated on the basis of race. And it's happening in the U.S. So why should it happen in Latin America? Why should it happen?
For Mercier and for others, the heart of the matter is this. taking away the citizenship of a people is a dangerous and scary move. It's been the precursor to genocide, and it diminishes the rights of all people, no matter where you're from. We promise to keep you up to date on this important and developing story about Latinos and Latin Americans. When you lose your citizenship, you lose so much, including your potential. In fact, we're witnessing that right now in our country. Think about the Dreamers, brought here as children without papers. They grew up here, and many were great students and could have done great things in this country. But Dreamers have been deported in record numbers. So all of that potential that could have stayed here is gone. In Mexico, those who get deported there are called Los Otros Dreamers. Reporter Brooke Binkowski caught up with a few of them and has this story.
The United States and Mexico meet at a high fence topped with barbed wire that sprouts out of a beach in Playas, Tijuana. Friends and family call to each other across the border. Carlos Smith sits on a bench on the Mexican side, looking through the border wall toward his former home.
We get depressed because we're not accepted as human beings.
Carlos Smith isn't his real name, but if people found out he was not in Mexico by choice, it could cost him his job.
For people to say that you were deported, is like the word deportation creates a big stigma. And people are looked down upon again.
Living undercover on both sides of the border has left him feeling like a man without a country.
You know, regardless whether you're over there or over here, you know, it's the same thing.
Carlos is 37. We're almost exactly the same age. Like me, he grew up in San Diego. We saw the same bands, swam at the same beaches, probably went to the same football games. But there's one difference. He was deported a couple of years ago, just after he finished his master's degree.
I don't seem mad. Well, a lot of people who know me, you know, they will tell you that I'm mad all the time. I will talk about it often all the time. So yeah, even though I don't show it, you know, I'm mad.
There are about 500,000 young people on the other side, according to researchers in both countries. There's a song that resonates with them. No soy de aquí, ni soy de allá. I'm not from here, I'm not from there.
No soy de aquí, ni soy de allá.
Even if for fellow Latinos who go to the places of origin, they feel like they don't belong.
Once they're in Mexico, young people can run into a thicket of roadblocks, like not being able to use their American education. Just ask Nancy Landa, who was deported 4 years ago. She's sitting in a downtown coffee shop on the other side of Tijuana. Her entire schooling was in the U.S., including college. But no grad school in Mexico would accept her, so she decided to go to work. She kept quiet about her deportation for a long time.
I was afraid of being stigmatized or criminalized. But later on, I realized that many, like when you look at me, I don't look like the deportees that, you know, are showcased in media. But at the same time, I think that was the reason why I needed to come out, so people can understand that we're not the stereotype that you see in the media.
Nancy has appeared in articles and books. She also keeps a blog called Mundo Citizen, World Citizen, talking about her life as a deported dreamer.
I think there's a power of being able to share your experience. The whole dreamer thing has given a lot of power and voice to a lot of people.
Having that voice is especially important to those who have been dropped in Tijuana with little social network or safety net. Over the border, in San Diego, Carolina Valdivia is sitting at a computer writing an email to Carlos Smith. They've never met, but they're connected by common experience.
Even though we weren't friends while he was here, for whatever reason, like our paths hadn't crossed yet. Now that I do know about him and that he knows about me, that there is that friendship that he can count on, and that I'm here for him and vice versa.
Carolina is also undocumented, but she's spoken out about her status and the need for immigration reform for years. She's part of a loose-knit but vital social network for those who otherwise have very little support. The future's uncertain for all of them, but that hasn't kept them from making plans. Carolina's been accepted into a PhD program in Chicago. After years of trying, Nancy did find a school that would accept her, all the way in London. Meanwhile, Carlos is applying to PhD programs in the States as an international student.
For some of us dreamers, it's a constant struggle, yes, but we're constantly thinking of ways to better ourselves or ways of going back to where we belong, where we want to help our own community, our fellow mothers and fathers and sons, daughters, everybody.
He hopes to mentor young people in the U.S. who, like him, are caught in the immigration shuffle. For Latino USA, I'm Brooke Binkowski in Tijuana, Mexico.
Around 400,000 immigrants are detained every year in our country. Many of them, about 15,000 in 2010, were simply asylum seekers who didn't have a criminal record and are held in detention before being granted refugee status. Critics say detaining political and human rights refugees is not only immoral, but expensive and harmful. But one place may have found a solution. Amy Bracken has our story.
Hola. ¿Cómo está?
A mother of four we'll call Lydia fled her home in Honduras about a year ago. She's living safely in Austin now in a group home for immigrants called Casa Marianela. But her way here wasn't quick or easy. She made it to South Texas, where she was locked in a smuggler's stash house. That's where the Border Patrol found her.
I felt really bad. I started crying and said I can't go back.
She told an immigration officer that her husband had sliced her with a machete and threatened to kill her. Immigration told her she could apply for asylum. But in the meantime, she was held in isolation.
They put Dalgo Jail in the hole, and they didn't tell me when they'd let me out. I was there 25 days in solitary confinement. I didn't see anyone, just the guards who gave me food and looked in through the window.
Eventually, Lydia was transferred to general detention, but she could only call her kids once a month or so. When she did, they told her they had nothing to eat.
I felt so desperate, I wanted to kill myself. But I asked God for strength, and I would tell myself, you can't do that. Why did I flee from being killed there just to do it here?
10 months after her arrest, Lydia got a letter from Casa Marianela, and she was allowed to go.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going to do the chores.
Casa Marianela sits on a leafy street in Austin, Texas. For 27 years, it has sheltered immigrants. At this week's House meeting, staffer Eric Ashkenaz hands out forms explaining the immigrants' right to work. He speaks a mix of French, Spanish, and English. There are men and women here from Latin America, Asia, and Africa. Many of them are seeking asylum or just received it.
Alexis, llegó. Un poco tarde, pero aquí.
Casa Marianela links its residents to seemingly endless services. Legal aid, psychotherapy, art class, even hospice.
Los medicamentos.
But Ashkenaz says one service is especially crucial.
I've had people here that say, you know, the most important thing you did for me was write me that letter, because if you didn't, I would still be in jail.
Casa Marianela gets several letters a week from people in detention asking to come stay. If Casa writes an invitation back, it can convince a judge to let them out.
Dear sir/madam, I'm refugee from Bangladesh. I have problems in Bangladesh. That's why I left and seeking asylum in America. Now I'm in South Texas Detention Complex.
In June, Casa Marianela became part of a new Alternatives to Detention pilot program, with Lydia as one of its first participants. The way it usually works, asylum seekers who are let out of detention face a lot of restrictions, like having to wear ankle bracelets. But Lydia is being treated just like anyone else at Casa Marianela.
So far, what I've seen, this is completely just from my own observations, is that individuals are happy.
Anna Campbell is with Lutheran Immigrant and Refugee Services, the group spearheading the pilot. She's been monitoring the project's 7 sites and will make yearly reports to the government.
Individuals enrolled in this project are able to take a deep breath and relax and enjoy and really maybe rehabilitate from some of the trauma and experiences that they're fleeing from.
The residents of Casa Marianela heal in a variety of ways. A Rwandan artist builds a memorial to victims of the 1994 genocide. A Salvadoran woman who saw her family massacred sits alone in the shade down the street, and then comes in to cook dinner. For Lydia, her glassy eyes and quiet demeanor suggest she's still in pain, but she says she's in the right place.
Here, there's lots of support. English class, medical assistance, being able to talk to my lawyer when I need to. Here, I feel very good. There, in detention, life didn't exist for me.
And having a life is something Lutheran Immigrant and Refugee Services considers important. They're out to show the government that letting asylum seekers live freely is healthier for the individual and society at large. Lydia says she's eagerly awaiting her next court date, a step closer, she hopes, to being legalized in the U.S. and getting a job. For Latino USA, I'm Amy Bracken, Austin, Texas.
Amy Bracken is an immigration reporting fellow with the French American Foundation. People who come to our country have to adapt, and sometimes that means losing their language. For speakers of Zapotec, one of the 62 official languages indigenous to Mexico, that may mean losing it entirely. But here in the U.S., the language may have found a way to survive. Ruxandra Guidi has this report.
My house? Lija. Your house? Lija. Her house for kid?
Everyone in this makeshift Los Angeles classroom can trace their origins to a single village in Oaxaca, Mexico, a place called San Bartolomé Sogocho.
Most of us live here. We have a ghost town basically back home. Very few people are there.
Odilia Romero came to Los Angeles with her parents in the 60s when she was a little girl. Hundreds left their village for jobs in the U.S.
The elders are, well, unfortunately dying out. And now, so we're hoping people will develop a love for the language.
That language is nothing like English or Spanish. The words don't even translate directly. In Zapotec, meanings are much more lyrical. For instance, you're not listening to the radio right now, you're listening to Lien Chulien, which means something that's singing or playing a song.
Esto is our, but not yours.
But not, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now there are only 400 people left in San Bartolomé Sogocho who speak Zapotec. On the other hand, Los Angeles is home to about 1,500 Sogochenses.
So if anything, if the language was to be rescued, it would be here in LA. But if we don't do anything about it, by 2050 it'll be gone.
Teaching Zapotec to the next generation of Oaxacan Americans is key to its survival.
It's not just about it's a language, but it's who it ties you to.
That's 25-year-old Octavio Velez.
It ties you to community, it ties you to an identity. And I think that's really important for people to have in the world.
Octavio's wife, Janet, sits next to him. Her dad is a first-generation Sogochense. He wasn't keen on teaching her Zapotec when she was a kid.
He always told me, like, you know, I would prefer for you to learn English because I feel like you need it for school. Zapoteco, nobody's going to speak it anyways.
But now, not only are people speaking here in class, it is also having a renaissance online. Janet, Octavio, and the others have created a page on Facebook that they use to keep in touch with relatives back in Mexico. It includes an online dictionary of common Zapotec expressions. For Latino USA, I'm Ruxandra Guidi in Los Angeles.
Shaga. Shaga. Dala. Dala.
Coming up, rediscovering Brazilian choro music. Stay with us on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So chances are you're listening to this radio in your car. But in developing countries, especially those with low literacy rates, radio is sometimes the only source for news and information. Here in the U.S., with the memory of Hurricane Sandy just 1 year away, we discovered that when disaster hits, we often go back to relying on the radio. For this week's News or Noise, our regular feature about news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario talked about Hurricane Sandy with a few teens who recently found their passion for our favorite medium.
Now, before we get started, real quick, to get your attention, I'm going to say something like, holla back.
Here at Latino USA, we love radio.
Y'all gonna say,
got your back.
We love making it.
Right, y'all got it?
We love listening to it.
Got it, yes. So holla back.
I met some teenagers who felt the same way at the Digital Waves Festival in Brooklyn, New York.
Holla back.
Radio is, it's wonderful. I can just hear so many sounds. I love it. Like, I can just look at something and I can imagine the sound of it. It's a beautiful thing.
Bree Person was trained in radio reporting as part of a program called Radio Rookies. She talked about hearing a radio story for the first time and being moved by the emotion in the voice. Danielle Motin de Beca, who also trained, loves that radio lets her focus.
When you're watching like a video, you're interested in the picture and you just, it gets confused. But when you listen to radio, you're concentrating in listening to the words that the person is saying. So yeah, that's why I like it.
Radio can also be a lifesaver. In case of emergency, the Red Cross recommends making a survival kit. On the list of items to include, at a bare minimum, is a radio. Many people on the East Coast found themselves in a position where they needed one of those kits last year. Alex Estevez remembers.
Hurricane Sandy was, you know, it was tragic. I remember me being in my house and just seeing everything, just all the poles in the corner just drop, trees. Like, I remember seeing all that, like all the water in the floor. My teacher, actually, he lost his entire house.
Robert Smith lives in Red Hook, a neighborhood in Brooklyn that Sandy hit especially hard. His neighbors are still recovering every day.
Because there's some people that still have, like, no power and stuff like that, or, like, the water is still, like, weird. Like, we still have, like, giant boilers outside of the buildings.
New York is huge. Even within the city, it can be hard to comprehend the damage to Brooklyn if you live in the Bronx. Kahalia Parfait said that what makes her understand it the most is the sound of those affected themselves.
That's more powerful than just you hearing it from somebody else. You know what I mean? It's hearing it from that exact person to say, I'm left with nothing. Like, this is still going on in my life. And I think some people, I don't know for what reason, might not care. But other people and most people will have feelings and will say, I could be that person.
Some of the teens I spoke with are hoping to pursue radio journalism as a career. They want to tell stories that aren't being told. They're hoping to make you care. For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Before samba and bossa nova, Brazilians played a lilting style of music called choro, which is Portuguese for lloro, or to cry. Choro music always features the little cry of the accordion. Choro was made popular in Brazil by artists Cinquinha Gonzaga and Pixiquinha. And in recent years, choro has undergone a little bit of a revival. Producer David Schulman met up with a Washington, D.C. group called D.C. Choro.
My name is Gigi Rezende McLaughlin. I'm from the northeast of Brazil, and I came to the United States in 1992. We are in Washington, D.C., Adams Morgan, in front of the grill from Ipanema at the Brazilian restaurant. My case here, my accordion. Accordion is a very popular instrument in Brazil. I love the sound, the groove. Quando olhei a terra dentro, com a fogueira de São João, eu perguntei a Deus do céu, o que
the popular instrument, you know. It's like here, everybody likes the guitar. You know, it's very characteristic in choro. But we are going to have tonight trombone player, clarinet.
My name's Andy Connell. I'm an associate professor of ethnomusicology at James Madison University in Virginia. My main interest and research has been Brazilian instrumental music. I played a lot of choro in Brazil and here and on the West Coast. And there's a lot more people playing it now. But certainly Americans, when they hear it, most people know bossa nova and not much else. And then they hear this and it's something completely different. Choro is not so much one rhythm or one style. It's like saying jazz or rock and roll. There's a lot of styles within it. For us, it's total fun to play, and then I think most audiences, when they hear it, they hear that fun.
Some people say that the choro is like the New Orleans jazz because they use a lot of improvisation. So, what do you want to hear? You want to hear some choros? Choro can be like a samba. If we play gaúcho, that's different rhythm one. You see the difference? Very different. I'm gonna play for you a Pixinguinha song that calls, it's very popular in Brazil, Carinhoso. Choro develops in Rio in the late 19th century. It's a combination of African, Brazilian, African rhythms and Europe music. My father was a violin player at the symphony orchestra, and my aunt was a great classical piano player, and they loved this woman that was very famous, Chiquinha Gonzaga. That time in 1930s, you know, Chiquinha Gonzaga, a woman goes to a bar and they play, and all my aunts play all Chiquinha Gonzaga songs for us. That's the way that I learned so much about choro.
My name is David Sachs. I'm a clinical psychologist. I play trombone with DC Choro. The first Brazilian musicians that I met were, they were in New York and they were there to learn from jazz. But they said, you know, you have to study Pixinguinha and you have to study the Choro masters to really learn the music of Brazil.
Little girl.
I went back to Brazil in 2005. I took four American musicians with me. People was listening to us and they really loved the musicians. I think this music never is gonna die. Choro for me never is gonna die.
Our next music piece features a man who loves to find music in dozens of instruments, from guitarra gitana to a donkey's jawbone. 6 years ago, Sinue Padilla y Sunce started a band and called it Jarana Beat. Willis Arnold has this profile of a musical odyssey.
The music of Jarana Beat is like pozole, a traditional Mexican stew. A medley of different influences. With the right ingredients, says Sinue Padilla Isunza, anything can happen.
All this fusion here is like the kitchen. Make a new plate, make a new dish, you know?
His wife, Claudia Valentina, elaborates.
What I love about it is that most of them are kind of the roots of Mexican music. And it's not just Mexican music. There are Puerto Rican roots in our music, African roots are there, the indigenous roots are there.
Sinue's voracious musical appetite drives most of the group's sound. He began learning traditional songs at 13 in his hometown of Mexico City. He sings one for me in his home studio in Brooklyn. It's in the indigenous language, Nahuatl. But Sinue didn't stop there. He was always hungry for more.
I went to the conservatory and I want to play jazz with the jarana. I want to play blues. I want to make fusion. It sounds beautiful.
The jarana is a traditional Mexican instrument that looks like a miniature guitar. Sinue was inspired to learn it as a teenager when he attended a fandango, a traditional communal concert that can last for days. Sinue noticed a similarity between jarana rhythms and traditional Spanish flamenco music, and just like that, he decided to move to Spain.
How much you bring me for my freezer? $10. Go. How much you bring for my TV? $5. Go. I sell everything, and I went and I buy a ticket for Madrid, no back.
3 months after his arrival, a neighbor hooked him up with a teacher who lived on the outskirts of Madrid. He recounts a typical lesson.
They didn't say to you C or A or in my or nothing of that. They said, look, the compás, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Oh, you got it? And you, 7, 8, no, got it. 2, 1, 2, 3, I need a coffee. Come back. In. All right. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 10 minutes later, you got it.
A decade ago, Sinue left Spain and landed in Brooklyn. In 2007, he formed Jarana Beat, named after that miniature guitar, and the band began to take off. The band is playing a show for elementary school kids in the Bronx. They dance like they can't control themselves, shuffling and rocking back and forth, with grins plastered across their faces. But Jarana Beat's music cuts across all age groups. Hugo Moreno plays several instruments with the band, says they connect with young and old.
There was a fandango, and I took my mom to one, you know, and I just thought it was a gig, and I thought, you know, she'd think it was interesting.
She did. She stepped onto a dance platform and started to move her feet.
She used to dance back in the day. She was a folkloric dancer. I had no idea.
There have been more surprises along the way, including Claudia's favorite story from last year's South by Southwest Festival.
One of our band members, Juanito, met his now-to-be wife. We played at a place called Bohemios in Houston, and they met there. She was working there. And that night, she dropped everything, hopped in the van with us, drove to Austin, and it's, you know, been history. So that's amazing.
Their community keeps growing. In the past month, they've played venues as varied as the Smithsonian's National Museum of the Native American and local clubs and concert halls. Listening to Jarana Beat, you feel like part of the community, no matter what your background. Listen. And the care of the world slides away. For Latino USA, I'm Willis Arnold.
Quiero el corazón como es tan tarde.
When you find something that's been lost, there's a sense of relief, like a chapter of a book being closed. So now some words of wisdom, some sabiduría, from a Latino Marine who is dedicated to closing chapters of people's lives. His life is dedicated to bringing relief to families whose loved ones are lost, missing in combat.
My name is Captain Byron Owen, and I'm a ground reconnaissance officer in the United States Marine Corps.
2 years ago, I had a great opportunity to join an organization within the Department of Defense whose mission is to locate and retrieve the remains of missing service members across the world. What we would do is locate them on the seafloor using sonar and then recover them with divers, or go into the jungle, locate aircraft crash sites, and excavate the remains and then bring them back to the United States. None of these families really are holding out hope that their grandfather is running around Papua New Guinea somewhere alive, but it really puts a period at the end of that sentence, and it ends the story for them, and it gives them a sense of completion. Even though I'm bringing back the remains of their ancestor, their father, their grandfather, there's joy because the mourning is over, and now it's just that yearning for completion to find out what had happened, after all this time to their relative in Vietnam or World War II, and that's really something I found very personally and professionally satisfying. I think the best advice I got for this job was to never give up. This kind of job is something where you have to look at a problem from different directions and be creative about your problem solving, especially in a place like Papua New Guinea or Vietnam, where you're dealing in another culture. And if you approach something from one direction and you keep trying to get the same result by doing the same actions, he's like, you're going to fail. When you look at today's world, being a Latino, it means that you're coming from a multicultural background. Now you go into a place like Papua New Guinea, or you go to Iraq or Afghanistan, and now once again, you're dealing with people from different cultures. I think having that multicultural background, or having that ability to interact with someone from a different culture, because we all do on a day-to-day basis as Latino in America, and that gives you a better perspective, and you can understand somebody who is different. You don't look down on them. And that means a lot to that person, and it makes you a more effective leader. And in the Marine Corps and in the Department of Defense, we have a very diverse population, both enlisted and officer. And I think that being from another culture allows you to connect more with your Marines across ethnic lines. I think that's very important.
We hope you found something wonderful in this week's show and lost yourself in our sounds and stories. Do let us know on Facebook and on Twitter, gente. We are Latino USA. And that's it for this week's show. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, Nancy Trujillo, and Michael Jones. Jonathan Wolf is our intern. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Do join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram at Maria_La_Hinojosa. Until next time.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.